Yo, what's up? It's your boy Dan. I'm in River North, most hardcore place in Chicago, and you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Dan. River North, I guess. Hardcore? Are we talking about partying hardcore? Is that what's happening here? I suppose there's an argument to be made with that. Hope you're okay, Dan. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. This is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 846, and what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And we say good morning to Bob Ferguson, who is the engineer in the WGN radio studio today, as he usually is, spinning the dials and pushing the buttons and making us sound great on the air. And happy new year, a little early. Unless you're listening on the podcast, then who knows? But happy new year nonetheless. 2022. Wow, what happened? I think it flew by. At least that's how it feels for me. I mean, I was thinking about this week that it doesn't feel like that long ago. It was summertime. The weather was great. We were outside. And I know that this week it swung, the temperature swung about 50, 60 degrees. So maybe that's what's confusing me. But I just feel like the whole year was just really, really fast. So what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate the year that was. And by the way, if you're going out tonight, please be careful. I know that we're all anxious to get back out into public situations. At least a lot of people that I know are. And New Year's Eve, boy, you talk about a hardcore party. You can certainly find those in Chicago. I have not been out on New Year's Eve, certainly within the last few years because of the pandemic. But even before then, it's been a while since I've gone out to a restaurant or some sort of party on New Year's Eve. And I know I sound like an old guy right now, but here I am in my early 40s with a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old at home. And so I'm thinking I'm going to hit midnight. We've got some neighbors coming over. The kids are going to play. We're going to have the pretend countdown at about 10 o'clock for the kids with their sparkling apple cider. And I don't know. That might be it. 21-year-old me right now is saying, what are you doing? But that's our plans for New Year's. And I've done the whole restaurant thing, which is fun. But I remember getting out of a restaurant or a bar on New Year's, even with ride sharing apps. It's hard to get a ride home. And really, everyone should be getting a ride home. Please don't drive. Take the CTA. They do their penny thing. You know, you pay a penny, you get to ride the CTA on New Year's. Please do that. That's my suggestion to you. But regardless, whatever you're doing, have a great time, be safe. And since it is New Year's Eve on today's show, we're just going to take a look back on some highlights of this program, Outside the Loop. Of course, you can get full shows up at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and, of course, WGNRadio.com. Subscribe to the podcast. It is free, and it gets delivered to your device each week. No charge, because I love you. And you get some bonus content on the podcast, so check that out wherever you get your podcasts. So today we'll hear some highlights from the year that was 2022, kind of like a year in review almost, but we don't have that much time, and we've covered a lot of topics, and I think you'll get kind of a nice cross-section of some of the more serious topics and history topics that we do, and then the lighter topics, kind of off the beaten path, of course, all about Chicago and Chicagoland. And look, if there's anything that I really love about this time of the year, aside from the whole holiday spirit thing, is the traffic is a little bit lighter. Just a little bit, though. I was on the Eisenhower a couple times this week, and, you know, the 3-4 o'clock hour when stuff starts to get really hairy, and I was moving outbound too. So, Look, enjoy that while we have it, because I have a feeling coming back this week that traffic situation is going to change. And I know it's never great around here, but also lots of side streets in Chicago, residential parking, because people are visiting family out of town. Take advantage of that. Some of the perks of this holiday season. Let's get to it. We'll take a look back on the year that was 2022 right here on Outside the Loop. Since we are taking a look back on 2022, let's go back to April and hear this clip from Outside the Loop number 810. Enjoy. In the 20th century, in the United States and here in Chicago, racially restrictive covenants were legal agreements used to promote racial segregation. These restrictions were so widely used in Chicago that it was estimated that 80% of the city's homes were covered by racial covenants. The Chicago Covenants Project is working to unearth documents to illustrate how racial segregation in northern cities was not accidental. LaDale Wingling is a history professor at Virginia Tech. He's also the project director for the Chicago Covenants Project. You can check out that website, chicagocovenants.com. And LaDale Wingling is here with us on Outside the Loop today. LaDale, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. So, okay, I mentioned that this is happening in the 20th century, these instances of these racial covenants. But specifically in the 20th century, when is this taking place?
The legal justification and the practices go back to the late 19th century, but they really intensify. And we see many, many more instances of these racial covenants in cities around the time of the Great Migration. Basically, 19-teens, 1920s is when they become like extremely popular tools to prevent racial integration and racial mixing in neighborhoods in Chicago and other cities like it.
So give us an example here. Okay, we're talking about racially restrictive covenants, but what would that mean? What does that say? What does that look like?
In Cook County in Chicago, we found kind of two examples of this, two types. And one is created by a real estate developer when they subdivide a piece of land and they set out the lots and they put development restrictions on it. And in those cases, there may be restrictions like must only be used for single family residents, may not cultivate like farm animals or something along these lines. And one of these restrictions that we see again and again is that this property may never be sold to, leased by, or inhabited by someone who is not a member of the Caucasian race. And that's like before anyone builds a house or moves onto the property. So those are called plat restrictions. And then there's another type in, and those plat restrictions are often in kind of outlying areas, kind of suburban developments, whether it's in some cases like outlying areas of Chicago in the 19-teens and 1920s, or in kind of farther afield communities. But then we also see in a number of neighborhoods across the city where restriction associations, basically like neighborhood groups, create an agreement document. They file an agreement that says just kind of some of the same language, some of the same restrictions. It says this property, these premises may never be sold to, leased by, or inhabited by someone who is not a member, someone who is a Negro. So they basically, the in-town restrictions in these urban neighborhoods are explicitly against African Americans, whereas the kind of outlying restrictions say anyone who's not a member of the Caucasian race.
So your project, again, Chicago Covenants Project, it's online at chicagocovenants.com. You are working to dig up documents that are on file in Cook County, maybe buried a little bit somewhere in a file cabinet in Cook County. But what are you looking for specifically, and what is the significance of this?
Yeah, these were popular in the first half of the 20th century. In 1948, there was a Supreme Court case, Shelley versus Kramer, that ruled that these were unenforceable. But these kind of restrictions and these kind of patterns of real estate development have like long tails, right? They have enduring legacies that still shape the way that neighborhoods are populated and who lives in neighborhoods, right? Like patterns of segregation are enduring. And so what we're doing is we've got a wide array of like members of the public. We're kind of crowdsourcing this research in the county clerk's office. And there's kind of a basement storage room of index books. And we're looking through transaction after transaction after transaction, plat after plat after neighborhood after neighborhood, all around Cook County, and finding documents that say race restrictions, race restrictions, race restrictions in the teens, in the 20s, in the 30s, and the 40s. And, it's a little bit kind of like tedious for work, or a little bit like finding a needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm. But we found through kind of trial and error and practice that we can identify these. And there's hundreds of them, like probably more than 1,000, I would estimate, all across Cook County and throughout Chicago. And what we do is when we find the kind of notation race restriction, we call up the document and we confirm, like, yes, this is a covenant. And then we map these, and we're in the process of mapping these to try to find every covenant that was ever registered in Cook County, because we need to know like what neighborhoods implemented these, what neighborhoods like suffered from limited housing, and I think we need to promote a kind of thorough reflection on the role of housing segregation in racial inequality, as well as in kind of neighborhood conditions today. So, we're in the process of recruiting volunteers to train to do this kind of work. It's like we're detectives or like history sleuths finding these kinds of hidden documents that I'll say, it took me actually a couple of years to figure out how to do this. I spent a lot of hours in this kind of archive, kind of spinning my wheels, grinding my gears, thinking, gosh, we know these are here. How the heck do we find them? And we figured out the process, and we just need the kind of civic will and the kind of public engagement that we think is out there to find all of these, to say, like, this is who we were as Chicagoans and Midwesterners, but this doesn't need to be who we are going forward.
And ChicagoCovenants.com is the website. If you're interested in this project, definitely check out that site, ChicagoCovenants.com. Let's talk about the legacy of this, why we need to know this. I mean, yes, informing where we've been and who we are right now and where we want to go. But, I'm thinking about what happens after the 20s. We're in the Great Depression. It's the 30s. And then we get redlining, and those maps are drawn, color-coded maps, Chicago included. And you think about today, the legacy of all that. Why does the city of Chicago look like it does? Why do some areas have what they have? This is not an accident. This was intentional, and we live that legacy today. And I think what we're talking about with these racial covenants, you sort of trace that to understand the journey that some groups have had to go through, and again, who we are as a people. And I kind of see that as the legacy. Is that kind of what you see?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I study real estate and that we've kind of come to identify racial covenants, which are kind of closely aligned with or closely linked to redlining, is that this process, and I'll say, like, Chicago was the absolute center of redefining real estate thought and real estate practice in the 1920s and in the 1930s. And there was a effort by the National Association of Real Estate Boards to kind of popularize these covenants all around the country. And that was part of a process whereby individual bias and racism was turned into kind of a natural seeming system that seemed to be like race neutral, right? Mm-hmm. The idea was that mixing races would lead to lower property values, especially for white-owned land or white home buyers. And so the idea was, led by economists and real estate professionals, was that neighborhoods had to be kept separate or else, right, like property values would decline. And this became like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this became like fundamental to the real estate system that dominated throughout the rest of the 20th century. And so, as you emphasize, this is one of the mechanisms and a key fundamental mechanism that leads to redlining. I've studied redlining, and I helped kind of excavate these maps from the National Archives. And redlining was built on a foundation of racially restrictive covenants. Like many, in many cases, a neighborhood would be rated well or be rated better if there were racially restrictive covenants on property in the neighborhood. And so, you know, like the enduring legacy of real estate is that first with the creation of the long-term mortgage, there was the idea that, first of all, like stability was good for the purchase of real estate, for real estate prices, as well as for like neighborhood kind of investment. And paired with that was the idea that was not true, but it was kind of acted as if it were, treated as if it were true, that if something undermined the stability, if there was any kind of demographic change, whether it be Asians moving into a white neighborhood, African Americans moving into a white neighborhood, or Jews moving into a white neighborhood, then property values would plummet and like the neighborhood would deteriorate. And like I said, that it wasn't true, but public policy was layered upon that so that we did see these kind of forms of disinvestment and deterioration that contributes to like the racial wealth gap, for example, and that fundamentally shapes how cities made investments in infrastructure, in like upkeep, as well as the creation of like recreational resources, like parks, like open space, like street trees and tree canopy that actually we now know are key to urban heat islands and like have implications or consequences of kind of climate change. And these are really unequally felt in various neighborhoods throughout cities like Chicago.
Well, this gives us a lot to think about. And again, to understand the origins of this, what racial restrictive covenants were when it comes to real estate, and the ripple effect, as we're talking about here, how this impacts our society historically, but also how everything has sort of evolved into today. Check out ChicagoCovenants.com for the Chicago Covenants Project. It's fascinating work. LaDale Winling is a history professor at Virginia Tech. He's also the project director for the Chicago Covenants Project. LaDale, thank you so much for all of your hard work, your important research, I think, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thanks.
As we continue to look back on 2022 here on the show, let's go back to July of this year, outside the loop number 823 for this tasty conversation. Take a listen. If you ever find yourself taking a stroll in Columbus Park in the Austin neighborhood on a Sunday, boy, are you in for a treat. Follow your nose to the source of the delightful smell of barbecue. You will find incredible food and Chicago's semi-pro football team, the Chicago Falcons. They play on the football field in Columbus Park. Recently, I dropped by to see the Falcons head coach and barbecue pit master. This is what it sounds like. It's a lovely day here in Columbus Park, and it's so nice because the smell. It smells so darn good. I'm looking over here at a mobile barbecue pit, and this is all because of Tom Robinson, also known as Coach Rob, who is the head coach of the Chicago Falcons semi-pro football team. Coach, thanks for having us here. By the way, what is going on here? It smells delicious.
Well, I had to be creative in raising money for my team. My team I've owned for 32 years, the Chicago Falcons, and people generally don't donate money to older guys. My youngest was 17 and my oldest was 56. We just got him to retire after 35 years. So I always cook for the guys. I barbecued and I made spaghetti on the grill and say, well, we never seen people make spaghetti on the grill. I said, well, we make do. They said, you can make money doing this. So I went to Mississippi and I bought this grill that's on the trailer and it's a smoker. And so it's been helping I was able to have 5 home games this year at $1,400 a game.
So let's talk about what you're doing here, because the barbecue pit is just one part of it. The food is one part of it here in Columbus Park. The Chicago Falcons, so this is a semi-pro football team. Tell us how this works, because, you know, we live around here. All we think of is the Bears, right? But there is this other team, the Chicago Falcons. What are you all about?
Well, the Chicago Falcons started back in 1990 with a good friend of mine, Armin Covington, who actually was one of my assistant coaches at Orr High School. And we saw a lot of guys graduate from high school and never play football again. And the opportunity, they went to school, they didn't make it, so they sit around the house and got in trouble or did other things. So I have been familiar with semi-pro football. I was a player in 1975. I signed with the Denver Broncos in 1977. And so a lot of the younger guys say, Coach, can we get into semi-pro football? And then I started thinking. I said, well, you know, why don't we just start a team? And the rest was history, 32 years later.
So something you said there I think is really important, that this opportunity with the Chicago Falcons gives these men something to do, but really like something meaningful, because as you said, you were running into issues where these guys were just kind of hanging out, you know, not doing much or getting into some stuff they shouldn't be getting into. So this is a way to sort of correct that.
Yes. A lot of guys, you know, fall by the wayside. They were good athletes in high school, and some were just not equipped for college. And this gave them opportunity to play the game they love. We often have guys go to college, graduate, get good jobs. You know, Antoine Pearson graduated from Northern Illinois about 3 years ago. And he's doing real well for himself. So I watched these guys grow up from 14 years old, and my oldest is 55. No, I'm sorry, 60.
60? He's playing?
No, he's not playing.
Okay,
anymore.
Good.
No. These guys are still come around. They're still active with me. We have a large alumni following. We have over 2,000 followers registered on our website. We only have like 800 something. That's because I got tired of entering that stuff. You
know? It's a lot of work, and I think that's worth mentioning too. I mean, you're out here, you're selling some food, you're cooking this delicious food, but you've got to raise money, because this semi-pro football league, and it is a league. I mean, there are other teams in here that come here to the field at Columbus Park and you play. I mean, it costs a lot of money to do this, doesn't it?
Yes, it costs an awful lot of money. To run a home game, it costs anywhere between $13.50 to $14.50. We have to pay the officials. We have to pay to use the field. We have to have porta potties. And, you know, so we generated revenue. Like I say, I have a strong alumni association over the years, and we have a beautiful Chicago Falcons Hall of Fame banquet once a year in April. It's to die for.
Yeah.
When these guys who had nothing when they first started, and then they ended up getting jobs, starting their own businesses, hiring some of the players that's current now on the team, and reaching back, helping once what they were once at one time.
So there's that Hall of Fame. You're in the Hall of Fame, aren't you? Yeah, see?
Actually, I'm in four Hall of Fame.
Well, now, tell me about that. You're in four Hall of Fames, yeah. Or Halls of Fame. What is that? What is that?
Actually, if you Google American Football Association, Minor League Football, AFA, you will see that there's over 500 teams in the United States, Hawaii, and Canada alone. I was actually on one of the first teams that visited Europe to introduce American football back in 77. So that's something to Google, you know. We have our Hall of Fame banquet for the American Football Association in Canton, Ohio, every year in June, the third week in June. And it's a beautiful thing when guys go and get inducted into the Hall of Fame. And it's very similar to the NFL Hall of Fame. And we run the Chicago Falcons Hall of Fame exactly the same way.
So how often are you out here in Columbus Park with your food and your games? How often does this happen?
Well, my team is kind of unique. I coach year-round. Usually during the football, we play summer football, we play winter football, we play spring football. We generally go, starting in September, every Tuesday night, we go to a passing league in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So we keep those guys involved until December, and then December we have our annual banquet. And then in January, in the snow, out here at Columbus Park, it's knee-deep, we shovel the snow, and we start practicing.
That's hardcore football right there. I love that. So, all right, Coach, ChicagoFalconFootball.com is the website. But you've been doing this now for over 30 years, right? Why do you keep doing it?
Well, 32 years. We just finishing up our 32nd year. I tried walking away a couple of times. My wife said, I've been married 45 years next month. She said,
congrats.
Thank you. She said, you're not going to stop. You're going to go. And I just find myself saying, I'm not stopping. I mean, I love this. I love to cook, and I love to coach. And that's what I did, you know, all my life. I coached and helped young people find a way for themselves. We feed the homeless. When they come up, they don't have money, no problem. And we invite them up from the viaduct to come and sit down with us. They come and sit. We sit tables out. And we really started feeding the homeless once every first Sunday of the month, and starting in March. And so that's how this all is. And people came up to want to buy the barbecue because they say it smells good, it tastes good. So I said, why not? I need the money, so.
Why not, right? Well, it is amazing here what you're doing. I stumbled upon you here in Columbus Park, and here we are, but here you are doing this again, ChicagoFalconFootball.com. It's a really great story and a wonderful opportunity for these young people who get to, and I guess older people too, who get to be a part of the Chicago Falcons semi-pro football team. Coach Tom Robinson, thank you so much for talking to us today. Keep doing what you're doing. It smells unreal over here in Columbus Park.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And I just want to give a big shout out to Dave Birch and the American Football Association of Minor League Football. If you ever get an opportunity to Google it, you can actually, it's in the archives, all the ceremonies that happens at the Hall of Fame, at the NFL Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio.
Back up.
All right. I know you have lots of New Year's plans, and maybe you have the resolution or three that you have to work on. So we have time for one more clip. This comes from September of 2022. Going back to Outside the Loop number 832. Let's roll that. The COVID-19 pandemic has resulted in increased struggles when it comes to making ends meet. There are many residents of this area who are having trouble paying bills. And at the very least, this pandemic has put a spotlight on the inequality that exists in our society. So here's a question. Do you think that if you are struggling to pay your bills, maybe your neighbor would step in to help out? Well, that's the idea behind Community Utility. It's online at communityutility.org. Anson Tong is the co-creator of that website, and she is also an analyst at the Center for Radical Innovation for Social Change at the University of Chicago. And she is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Anson, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. So this concept here, I mean, really, here's what it comes down to. It's as simple as neighbors basically stepping in and paying utility bills. That's essentially what this is, right?
Yes. Yeah. Our website, Community Utility, is built on this idea of mutual aid, which it is a political idea, but I think also people realize they're doing it a lot in their daily lives, right? It's premised on the idea that, like, sometimes you will need help and sometimes your neighbor will need help, and we take care of each other and we build community. And it's not a transactional, like, oh, I'm donating money and you need money, the way traditional charity works, but it's about knowing that other people are there to support you and care for you. And that can be about money, like paying utility bills, but it can also be about, you know, watching your children, walking your dog, bringing you food when you're sick. And we want to build that sort of sense of understanding and that belief that, like, you have someone to turn to when you need help, and you are also able to help the people that are around you.
Yeah. So really, this idea of mutual aid already exists in our communities. If you think about it, just being a good neighbor. So maybe shoveling your neighbor's sidewalk, or as you said, maybe you watch the neighbor's kids for an hour or two if someone's running late, you know, stuff like that, bringing over food. So you're kind of fostering this idea that we're already looking out for each other as a community. So this is kind of an extension of that. You're just paying someone's utility bill who's maybe having a tough time right now.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think the financial aspect of it is a little more uncommon, right? In that we're not used to talking about that. But I think it's important to be real, right? That a lot of people are struggling for very big reasons, right? Like having COVID and not being able to work, or having some sort of other medical emergency, being laid off. And these are things where you can't control it and you might just be in a moment of vulnerability, and knowing that other people are there to help you is just a huge difference in how we think about society and community.
The website is communityutility.org. So how does this process work? Is it basically someone who's struggling goes on the website, posts a bill, and someone else says, hey, yeah, I'll pay for it? Is that how it works?
Yes, it's basically as simple as that. Basically, we had talked to a lot of community-based organizations in Chicago that already work with people who need help with their utility bills. And we looked into the existing, like, state and federal funding for this, which is called LIHEAP. And what we saw was that LIHEAP helps a lot of people, but it has a very long application and it requires quite a lot of documentation and it takes some time. And people tend to need their utility bills paid immediately, right? It's due at the end of the month and they might not be able to qualify because of income, or because they don't have the documentation, or they're not able to necessarily apply because they, you know, if you don't speak English as a first language, if you're older, don't know how to use the internet, don't have access to the internet, things like that. So we wanted to make it as low barrier as possible. So you can put in your name and your story or whatever other information if you want, but you don't have to, because we don't think people have to try to, like, justify that they deserve it. We're trusting that people are coming here looking for help. Mm-hmm. And then the requests go up. You can see them on our website, and then you can go pay. You don't have to pay a whole bill. You can pay part of it, because even $5 put in, if 10 people put in $5, you could help pay someone's bill off, right?
Sure.
And so then we take the information and we pay to ComEd or to People's Gas directly, and we're able to pay off someone's utility bill.
So it's just relying on the goodwill and good faith of the community to help people out. Now, I have to ask, this is not me being cynical, I'm an optimistic guy, but someone might hear this conversation and say, oh, well, all right, I'm making enough money, but can I just go onto this website and post my utility bill and maybe people are going to pay my utility bill and I kind of scam the system? Is that a concern?
I think I understand totally where that question comes from. I'm sure there are people who do scam the system, but I think we need to recognize that we tend to overweight this like fear that people are just going to steal all this money. And it's honestly easier for someone to just pay their bill if they're able to. And the reality is that so many people do genuinely need help. The bigger struggle that we face, if anything, is that people are ashamed or they feel stigmatized and they don't feel comfortable asking for help and accessing resources that are available. So I think that a lot of it is that we have trust that, you know, people are generally good and they're not going to do that. And also part of it is that we are going in and like paying their utility bill on their end. So it's not like you could lie about how much money that you need on your bill.
So, you know, I think this is a really interesting idea. And we have to think about here the fact that when we talk about welfare or financial aid or anything like that, it's not as easy as just signing up. I mean, this process, what you're doing through your website, is incredibly easy. Mm-hmm. But if folks who are struggling want to get some sort of aid, there's often a qualification process they have to go through, paperwork they have to fill out, and that is not an easy thing to do.
Yes. Yeah. There's a ton of administrative burden if you try to apply for something like Medicaid or SNAP or WIC. There's just a lot of forms that you have to fill out and a lot of documentation they might ask for that you don't have access to, or it takes a while for you to get access to. So it's actually very hard. And there are probably a lot of people who qualify for these kinds of government resources and they're just not even able to apply, or they don't know that they can't apply.
So this approach is interesting. And you've talked about before how you see this as kind of a humanizing tool. And this is very much, again, tapping into that neighborly sort of community that wouldn't it be great if we could all live in that? And so many of us do. I think we often don't recognize the fact that we do have people looking out for us in some capacity down the street or next door or wherever. This is really just kind of an extension of that. And, you know, the way that you're talking here is a way to bring all of us together even more closely.
Yes, for sure. I think that in a lot of ways, our community has gotten more atomized and we're more isolated than ever. I think a lot of people, right, you go to work, you might go to school, you know your family, and then it's hard to really get to know your neighbors or to feel like you really have roots in a place if you moved like newly to Chicago, for example. And so I think encouraging that idea of like, you know, I hope that when people wake up and it's like really hot outside, they think like, oh, like, I hope I can like help pay someone's AC bill, right? The awareness of like, this is like, we're all kind of going through life together and that sometimes people will need help. And sometimes you might need help, and understanding that it's a mutual process and you don't need to expect any sort of transactionality. And I think it's also very, very grounding in a time when you like read all these like horrible news stories and there's so many bad things happening and everyone will call for like, oh, you should donate to this thing and to this other thing. And that's really good. But when you like hit submit, it can feel kind of underwhelming, right? Of like, you don't really know what happened to the money. You don't really know what to do next. Where I think building the relationships is very important of like, you know, you are directly contributing to relief for someone. Like you are taking one thing off their plate and you are helping them be able to make ends meet for this month. And I think that's a very important feeling so that people can keep going and keep helping each other.
So how we can get involved here, basically, it's just as easy as us going to communityutility.org. And it's really straightforward. It's pretty streamlined. So if we need help or if we would like to help out, we just go to the website. There are instructions on how to do all that.
Yes, absolutely. And we also have on our website, if people live in Chicago or sort of in the area, other types of organizations or other suggestions of ways that, you know, you can connect to other people or you can learn more. Because I think our goal is that this is just a start and we want people to think about how throughout their lives, right, they can be more involved in their community, be more involved in mutual aid, be more aware of sort of the political context that also makes this crisis like exist right now.
That's right. We have to think about the larger reasons why we are in this situation. And I think the fact that a place like where you work, the Center for Radical Innovation for Social Change at the University of Chicago, I mean, you're trying to solve these big issues. And this is a really, I think, I want to say it's unique, but it's not like it's anything brand new. Neighborly, being neighborly and helping each other out. It's been around for generations. So we should all go to communityutility.org. Let's check out this website, and it's a pretty cool idea, and I'm glad that it exists and helping out a lot of people. By the way, how many people so far have you helped out in this area?
Yes, so we've been able to pay 19 people's bills. There's been over $5,000 that have been donated so far. We still have like probably 90 or 100 more requests that are on the page right now. So we could definitely use people's help.
All right. So check out communityutility.org. Anson Tong is the co-creator of that website and an analyst at the Center for Radical Innovation for Social Change at the University of Chicago. Anson, thank you so much for all of your hard work with this, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop, show number 846 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I do appreciate it. And I just want to say thank you for listening throughout the course of this year and previous years. I know that there are a lot of podcasts out there, and hopefully this one that comes your way each week is informative and entertaining for you. I know on my end, it is a labor of love. It's a lot of work that goes into this show, but I hope that you're taking something away from it. So thank you really so much for listening to this program. It means a lot to me, and hopefully, like I said, you're getting a lot out of the show itself. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer in the studio today. Happy New Year. Let's have a great New Year's Eve. Let's get into 2023. Here we go. I'll talk to you again next time, right here on Outside the Loop.